All right, welcome back to Britpop History, the podcast where we are reliving the Britpop years exactly 30 years on. In the real world, it's December 2022, but let's not live in the real world, shall we? Let's take ourselves back to a better time, a simpler time, December 1992. And it's a very different episode today. All of these up to now have been scripted affairs, but today we are recording live, effectively, and I'm joined by our good friend and contributor to the Oasis podcast and co-host of the Rain podcast and writer for Live Forever and Gigwise and various other publications, and the author of a number of great books, including, some might say, the official Oasis podcast book and books on the Verve and Arctic Monkeys. Anything else for you, Richard? Richard Bose.
Well, I'm thinking surely like director of the Oasis podcast network. Sure, yeah, I'm across all three now. I've got the hat trick. So yeah, I'm waiting for a kind of official recognition on that front, really. So when you're ready.
Yeah, I'll share the Patreon money, but that's I need that. I need that for my own personal reasons. So we're gonna be looking back at 1992. It's an interesting one because, you know, normally on these Britpop histories, I'm looking at the charts and I'm looking at all the sort of indie releases that were coming out. And sort of looking at, right, well, what was happening? What were the sort of the flourishing ideas and things that then led to Britpop sort of coming out in the later years? But having gone through December 1992, there wasn't any, really. I mean, there's a few indie singles were around. The Shaman were in the charts with Forever People. Wonder Stuff had their monthly release, as they did every month in 1992. But other than that, it was a very quiet year, a quiet month for indie. And so I thought, what would be really good fun would be to look back at 1992 as a whole, look at what had won the awards, look at what we think has sort of stood the test of time from that year, and then just generally get your thoughts on it, Richard.
Hit me, let's go for it.
Well, I'll start, as we always do, with what was happening in the news and stuff in December 1992. George Bush ordered 28,000 troops to Somalia. The Billboard Music Awards went to various people, including Whitney Houston, Garth Brooks, and Dr. Dre. Riddick Bowe, the heavyweight champion, threw his title in the bin rather than fight Lennox Lewis. Marco van Basten won the Ballon d'Or. The UK cinema was dominated by Sister Act, Death Becomes Her, Home Alone 2, and The Bodyguard. And The Bodyguard was just all-encompassing around that time, as I Will Always Love You was the number one throughout all of December and all the way into January as well. Other big singles of the time were Heal the World by Michael Jackson, Would I Lie to You by Charles and Eddie, Could It Be Magic, I Take That, and Slam Jam by the WWF Superstars.
June.
Yeah, so what was your, what are you, you're like 11 in 1992?
Yeah, so yeah, I've been 11, December 1992, yeah, I've been 11. So they replay, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, they do replays at Top of the Pops, and they do like two episodes a week. So they're now coming to the end of 93, but I watched sort of like 92s, and it was just like, that was kind of when my kind of formative pop music years were starting. So like, yeah, Would I Lie to You, Charles and Eddie, like that just takes me back to being sat by the stereo on a Sunday night, you know, recording the top 40. The Britpop bug hadn't quite bitten just yet, but yeah, I didn't realise Whitney Houston was number one for that long. I remember she was Christmas number one, but I didn't realise because you've got Bryan Adams in the summer, obviously, of 91. You've got Meatloaf in the autumn of 93 with I Do Anything for Love. But I loved Whitney Houston. That was it, 15 weeks at number one, something stupid like that? I didn't realise there was that many. That's mad.
It was one of those, it was that time when you did have, these songs that dominated like weeks and weeks and weeks at number one, same as because I think it was Whitney Houston did 14 or 15, and then Wet Love Is All Around then on the, that was, course, then, yeah, what, 94, and that then I think beat it I think it was, yeah, she hadn't beat Bryan Adams, or did she beat Bryan Adams and then Wet beat her? But yeah, you had these points where these things would just dominate, and obviously you still, people, it, this was physical sales in the chart this time, so yeah, and they tended to be, yeah, connected to the films as well, so you know, these were all big soundtracks. It's something we don't really get anymore, that you'd have like a big single connected to the big film, and then the film would dominate the box office and the song would dominate the charts.
It's so funny though, going back and watching these Top of the Pops, because people like Whitney Houston and Meatloaf are too big to go on Top of the Pops. So they just got the videos. Like, I think Bryan Adams did a couple of like satellite things, but essentially it's always just relying on the videos of these songs. It's quite funny. It's like, okay, today we're going to do the first 2 minutes. And then later on, okay, we can do the last couple of minutes, because especially in the case of Meatloaf, it's just like, you don't want to hear, I think it's like a 7 minute tune. But yeah, just, yeah, the days when, yeah, these people were too big. But yeah, that blew my mind that it was kind of that big. But you're right, yeah, there's no kind of real association with, well, is there association with films now? Maybe there is. I suppose you got, you know, Kendrick Lamar did Black Panther soundtrack a few years back, but I don't know what the chart success of that was. But yeah, Halcyon Days. Halcyon Days.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking back over the episodes we've done, obviously thinking about it is sort of these early sort of flowerings of Britpop. It was a funny year, and it's been really interesting to look back at these times, because, you know, we've had the likes of, you know, Blur and the Charlatans and the Manic Street Preachers, say, that were all bands that were, well, they deemed to be Britpop or sort of important in the Britpop era, you know, because there's always arguments over what was and wasn't Britpop. But all of these bands were people that had success before, you know, they'd had these, you know, Blur and Charlatans in sort of 90, and the Manics in 91 and 92, and then 92 you have Blur with Pop Scene, you have the Charlatans with Weirdo, even like the Lightning Seeds, similar, you know, Lightning Seeds had like Pure and stuff, but then into 92 you get like Life of Riley and things like that. And it feels like there's a number of bands that are sort of that were from that previous era, but then the sound is kind of changing. But then there's a number of other bands that were big in that era, like In Spiral Carpets and The Farm and people like that, that didn't really make it into Britpop. You know, they still sold records, they still had hits. But when we think of Britpop, we don't think of, you know, it's like In Spiral Carpets, really, or these sort of other bands, like, yeah. And then you've got like the Ned's Atomic Dustbin and Carter USM and people like that. So it's a really interesting kind of microcosm, 1992, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of like the changing the guard, isn't it? Like, I think you could also add like James to that list. I mean, they were late 80s, weren't they, James, when they first, I think, Sit Downs, what, 89, I think, maybe 1990. But then you again, watching these Top of Pops, they kind of pepper it, and they, you know, they had Laid in, was it late 94, was it 93, I forget. And obviously you've got the 97 Yeah, She's a Star and stuff, but you think of them as 90s songs, but not Britpop songs. But yeah, you're right. It's like you say, with Ned's Talk to Us, The Levellers, I think, is a great example. Yeah, and the Wonder stuff, you could see the kind of the guards, I say, slightly changing, but it wasn't apparent at the time. Do you know what I mean? It seemed rock music. I suppose 92, yeah, Nirvana was still, you know, reefing off Nevermind. So they were kind of, the grunge was kind of the impactful stuff in terms of like guitar music. At the period, but yeah, it's interesting to see what, yeah, where they were and what would become.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And if you look at, like, for instance, the Brit Awards 1993, I mean, this really shows us where the music scene was, and especially the British music scene, and really why, you know, when Noel came out, he said, "Oh, bring me the head of Phil Collins." You know, this was because this is what Britpop was fighting against. So the winners and nominees in 1993, so celebrating 1992, British Album of the Year was won by Annie Lennox, Diva, which, to be fair, is probably a good album. Then you've got Elton John, Genesis, The Orb, which is interesting, Right Said Fred, and Shakespeare's Sister. Single of the year was Take That, Could It Be Magic, with Shakespeare Sister Stay. Oh, this is, must have been a phone-in vote or something, because you've got Take That, It Only Takes a Minute, and A Million Love Songs, and then Goodnight Girl by Wet Wet. This is what annoys me here. British group was won by Simply Red. The other nominees were The Cure, Erasure, Right Said Fred, and Shakespeare's Sister. And then British male solo artist won by Mick Hucknall. So they gave the same guy best group and best solo artist. And as far as I'm aware, he didn't have like a solo album out in the same year. They just gave it to him twice.
Yeah, I mean, that's a crime on both fronts, isn't it? I mean, just giving the ginger tosser any kind of accolade is outrageous. To give him two, one that has absolutely no justification, is an outrage. But as I said, as I said to you on WhatsApp, it was the time of Sting and Phil Collins. So I suppose, it's much of a muchness really in terms of where it went. But yeah, that singles poll sounds like a phone in for radio, Radio 1 listeners to me.
Yeah. The other nominees for male solo were Elton John, Eric Clapton, George Michael, Joe Cocker, Phil Collins. And then you've got Best British Breakthrough Act, Tasmin Archer, Dina Carroll, KWS, Take That, and Undercover. Okay. And but then you look at like international group, REM, Crowded House, En Vogue, Nirvana, U2. An international breakthrough act, Nirvana won, Arrested Development, Boys to Men, Curtis Stigers, okay, and Tori Amos. So, it shows there was good stuff happening, but not necessarily, in the UK, there's not much exciting kind of,
There's no scene, is there? There's no scene. Yeah. There's no one thing to kind of, like, you've got the trance has gone kind of pop, or is on its way to becoming pop, like the next year. Not Enchanted, who am I thinking of? Too Unlimited. They're all across 93, but kind of moved into the Europop kind of stuff. But yeah, there's certainly no guitar scene. There's no kind of, there's one thing that leaps out. There's no kind of dominant genre at all, really, you'd say, certainly from those awards. Do you want to hear something scary?
Go on.
Phil Collins was about our age around about that time.
Jesus wept.
Mm-hmm.
It was also like Terry Hall. I was watching the brilliant Chasing a Rainbow, which he did in 1995. What a great song. And, he just nailed, like, the guy could do ska. He could do kind of that quirky 80s sort of skeletal kind of weird pop with Fun Boy 3. And then it's like, oh, yeah. And he just steps in and does Britpop. And he does Britpop fucking better than anyone. I mean, he did Sense. Obviously, Lightning Seeds then had the hit with. And Chasing a Rainbow is just brilliant. And he's 36 in that, which is just, which is just pretty shocking when you're watching that and you think, oh, this is sort of an older statesman. And yet he's 36 and you think, oh, my God. Yeah. I mean, I always sort of tend to think of it with Weller, because Weller was sort of mid 30s in the mid 90s. But then, yes, I think he was pretty much same age as Terry Hall, I think. But yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say. Another one from 92. Weller's kind of started his comeback trail, didn't he? Like, I think his first album came out in 92, but he was still obviously quite burned. But I think there was a kind of pre-Wildwood. I was like, okay, that's a good album. But yeah, Wildwood was obviously kind of when he went back to top table, as it were. I took a trip down Boundary Lane, trying to find myself again. At least the part I left somewhere.
So the album, so the Enemy Best Albums and Tracks of 1992 paints a very different picture, as you might imagine. So the album of the year was Copper Blue by Sugar on Creation Records. And then we had sort of second, we had REM, Automatic for the People, big album for me in around that time. Three, Spiritualize, Laser Guided Melodies. Four, Lemonheads, Shame About Ray. Five was Nick Cave, Henry's Dream. Six was PJ Harvey, Dry. Seven, Sonic Youth, Dirty. Eight, The Orb. Nine, Neil Young, Harvest Moon. And 10, The Black Crowes. And then you've got, so there's not a huge amount of UK stuff in there, really. And lower down, we've got Manic Generation Terrorist at 15, Denim, Back in Denim at 16, Morrissey's Your Arsenal at 19, The Fall, Code Selfish at 21, Stereo MCs at 28, Right Said Fred at 30, are you joking? Carter USM at 32, and the Boo Radleys at 50, and their tracks of the year. They gave Single of the Year to Suede, The Drowners. And then you've got PJ Harvey, Sheila, Nargig, Motorcycle Emptiness by The Manics, Creep by Radiohead, Drive REM, House of Pain, Jump Around. Who else have we got in there? L7, Pretend We're Dead, Suede, Metal Mickey, Pulp Babies at 11, Kingmaker in there, Stereo MCs. Yeah. So interesting. I mean, it's funny there's no Prodigy in there, actually.
I was just thinking that. It's notable the lack of the Prodigy experience.
Yeah, no Prodigy experience in the album or even in the singles. You know, I would have definitely thought Out of Space or maybe Charlie or something would have made it, but no. I mean, for me, they're as singles of the year, I think Pulp, and they no mention of Pop Scene either in the tracks of the year.
That was quite unheralded, wasn't it? Because I think they kind of, I think because the first album kind of tailed off a little bit, they kind of, that was around about the time they started going to America, wasn't it? And started to really kind of struggle. So it's,
yeah, you would have thought it made top 50. Bloody hell. But yeah, I mean, for me, Pulp Babies is the song of the year. I mean, that's one of my favourite songs. One of my favourite, probably my favourite Pulp song. I really liked the early Suede stuff. And the Manics, that album's got some brilliant songs in it. But yeah, I'd say Pulp Babies is my song of the year. And my album of the year, probably the one I've played the most out of those would be The Prodigy Experience or Generation Terrorists. Generation Terrorists I've absolutely hammered over the years. Yeah, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I mean, the standout, yeah, I agree with you, the standout there is Babies. But then, you know, you've got Creep, you know, that's quite a significant tune. You know, you've got The Drowners, which is interesting that a portend of things to come, that's the Enemy tracks of the year. That's quite, yeah, very much a kind of, the changing of the guard, as you say. But yeah, I mean, I think Creep already would be a lot of people's preferred choice. The albums, you've got Automatic for the People, you know, it's a classic. Sonic Youth. So yeah, again, it's kind of a lot of good stuff going on around the time. And probably, you know, that kind of era doesn't get much love, does it? But when you factor in the year before, you had Nevermind, Screamadelica, Acton Baby, you know, you've got these big, heavy-hitting albums that were kind of, that have stood the test of time. It'd be interesting to see, how the list would look for 93. Yeah, fascinating to see. Yeah, the pendulum between the US and the UK was kind of in mid-swing then, I would have said.
Yeah, it was very much over the USA at this point. But yeah, but then the UK was fighting back, and we will get there. So yeah, so what the albums that made 1992's for the 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die book, which my 1001 Albums series covered, although I did like 12, not 1001. Pavement, Slanted and Enchanted, Aphex Twin, Selected Ambient Works, Arrested Development, Kofi Olomide, don't know that, Morrissey, Your Arsenal, Baba Mal, Lemonheads, Rage Against the Machine's debut album, Disposable Heroes of Hip-Hopracy, K.D. Lang, Dr. Dre's The Chronic, R.E.M. Automatic for the People, The Far Side, Bizarre Ride 2, The Far Side, Spiritualized, Lady Gaga Melodies, Sugar, Copper Blue, Tom Waits, Bone Machine, Sonic Youth 30, Stereo MCs Connected. That's a big year. There's loads.
There's another... The Chronic.
Yeah, PJ Harvey, Dry, Nusrat Fateh, Ali Khan and Party, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Alice in Chains, Pantera, Ice Cube, Tori Amos, Ministry, Stereo MCs Connected. It's a lot of albums for one year. That's a big year for them. But once again, what we're seeing is primarily kind of American stuff, really.
Yeah, I mean, the Chronic being there, amazing. Like, I don't know a huge amount about Dre, but I know that's one of the most, one of the most influential albums of the genre, isn't it? The Chronic as well. So, factoring that in, and again, you know, it seems that that kind of hip hop and rap had gone a little bit sour. You know, by then, the after effects of Vanilla Ice are still being felt, but then you get something as important as that coming out, and it's like, kind of breathe new life into it, or gain it new respect, I guess. Maybe after a few people dragged it down a few ticks, but yes, huge year, massive. But as you say, kind of just adds further kind of fuel to what we were saying. There's no distinct theme, and it's all quite Americanized. Well, it's all quite American influence, should I say, and American led. But there were rumblings. There were rumblings in the jungle from Sussex and Colchester and Manchester and all other places of things happening and things to come.
It is interesting that, and I sort of, it's so annoying though, because I wish that all these bands had really detailed biographies of them, because it's like, well, what was Sleeper up to? All I know is that if you read the sort of the interviews and things about Sleeper, it's like, it was like, I'd love to know like when a lot of these bands' first gigs were, or when they were sort of first, when did they have their first meeting, songwriting session or whatever, and you just don't really get it too much. It's sort of, it's hard to define, because people don't tend to like sort of get these granular facts and details. We've got quite a good Oasis timeline, where okay, well, these are all the gigs. This is when they recorded this. This is when they're, that's been fun to sort of pick out, well, where they were and what they were up to in 92. But, so we know, for instance, like in 92, the Lars has sort of fallen to bits and John Power's forming cast at this time. You've got Shed Seven have come out and are sort of formulating what is going to become Changegiver, doing their first few gigs. And yeah, so around the country, you've just got these little pockets of things happening that are a bit separate, but there's not like a combined thing like when all these punk bands suddenly jumped up. It's like there's these little variations on a theme happening kind of around the country. And then, and as we see into 93 and then definitely in 94, when they all sort of do start to converge, and then it becomes what it became.
Yeah, I guess that's probably why it wasn't, why there isn't necessarily that granular information, because there's only particularly one resource. So you've got, like I say, rumblings in Sheffield, and you've got stuff in Sussex, and you've got all these different parts of the UK, but there's only like that band circle to record that part of that story. As opposed to like previous scenes, like both focused, being back in the 60s, with the Beatles moving down to London, that became the hub, and then you've got Manchester, obviously all kind of located in one place, but because everything's so disparate, there's maybe not the kind of, the ability to kind of record exactly what happened and what was going on at the time, which, would be an interesting read. And sounds like a good idea for a book.
If only someone had written a book that was good about that era. Anyway, all right, mate. Well, look, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have you on to Britpop History. And
nice to be here.
We will be back again. Well, I'll be back again next month in January as we join 1993. Where we'll be talking about everything that happened in 1993 as Britpop starts to develop even more.
No, thanks for having me. Pleasure to pop in. And keep up the good work. It's nice little tidbit at the end of every month, this little podcast. So keep it up.
Cheers. We'll see you next time.